But in what way? Kitty pursued with the same smile. Don't you two work for others? What about your farmsteading and your agriculture and your book? Oh, but I feel, and particularly just now, it's your fault, he said, pressing her hand, that all that doesn't count. I do it, in a way, half-heartedly. If I could care for all that as I care for you, instead of that, I do it in these days like a task that is set me. Well, what would you say about Papa? Asked Kitty. Is he a poor creature, then, as he does nothing for the public good? He? No. But then, one must have the simplicity, the straightforwardness, the goodness of your father. And I haven't got that. I do nothing, and I fret about it. It's all you're doing. Before you, and this too, he added with a glance toward her waist that she understood, I put all my energies into work. Now I can't, and I'm ashamed. I do it just as though it were a task set me. I'm pretending. Well, but would you like to change this minute with Sergei Ivanovich, said Kitty? Would you like to do this work for the general good and to love the task set you, as he does and nothing else? Of course not, said Levin, but I'm so happy that I don't understand anything. So you think he'll propose to her today? He added after a brief silence. I think so, and I don't think so. Only I'm awfully anxious for it. Here, wait a minute. She stooped down and picked a wild daisy at the edge of the path. Come, count. He will, he won't, she said, giving him the flower. He will, he won't, said Levin, tearing off the white petals. No, no, Kitty, snatching at his hand, stopped him. She had been watching his fingers with agitation. You picked off two. Oh, but see, this little one shan't count to make up, said Levin, tearing off a little half-grown petal. Here's the droshky overtaking us. Aren't you tired, Kitty? Called the princess. Not in the least. If you are, you can get in, as the horses are quiet and walking. But it was not worthwhile to get in. They were quite near the place, and all walked on together. Chapter 4 Varenka, with her white kerchief on her black hair, surrounded by the children, gaily and good-humoredly looking after them, and at the same time visibly excited at the possibility of receiving a declaration from the man she cared for, was very attractive. Sergei Ivanovich walked beside her and never left off admiring her. Looking at her, he recalled all the delightful things he had heard from her lips, all the good he knew about her, and became more and more conscious that the feeling he had for her was something special, that he had felt long, long ago, and only once, in his early youth. The feeling of happiness in being near her continually grew, and at last reached such a point that, as he put a huge, slender-stalked mushroom with rolled brims in her basket, he looked straight into her face, and noticing the flush of glad and alarmed excitement that overspread her face, he was confused himself and smiled to her in silence, a smile that said too much. If so, he said to himself, I ought to think it over and make up my mind and not give way like a boy to the impulse of a moment. I'm going to pick by myself apart from all the rest, or else my efforts will make no show, he said, and he left the edge of the forest where they were walking on low silky grass between old birch trees standing far apart, and went more into the heart of the wood, where between the white birch trunks there were gray trunks of aspen and dark bushes of hazel. Walking some 40 paces away, Sergei Ivanovich, knowing he was out of sight, stood still behind a bushy spindle tree in full flower with its rosy red catkins. It was perfectly still all round him. Only overhead, in the birches under which he stood, the flies, like a swarm of bees, buzzed unceasingly, and from time to time the children's voices floated across to him. All at once he heard, not far from the edge of the wood, the sound of Varenka's contralto voice, calling Grisha, and a smile of delight passed over Sergei Ivanovich's face. Conscious of this smile, he shook his head disapprovingly at his own state, and taking out a cigar, he began lighting it. For a long while, he could not get a match to light against the trunk of a birch tree. The soft pellicle of the white bark struck around the phosphorus, and the light went out. At last one of the matches burned, and the fragrant cigar smoke, hovering uncertainly in flat, wide coils, stretched away forward and upward over a bush under the overhanging branches of a birch tree. Watching the streak of smoke, Sergey Ivanovich walked gently on, deliberating on his position. Why not, he thought. If it were only a flash in the pan or a passion, if it were only this attraction, this mutual attraction, I can call it a mutual attraction. Yet if I felt that it was in contradiction with the whole bent of my life, if I felt that in giving way to this attraction I should be false to my vocation and my duty, but it's not so. The only thing I can say against it is that when I lost Marie, I said to myself that I would remain faithful to her memory. That's the only thing I can say against my feeling. That's a great thing, Sergey Ivanovich said to himself, feeling at the same time that this consideration had not the slightest importance for him personally, but would only perhaps detract from his romantic character in the eyes of others. But apart from that, however much I searched, I should never find anything to say against my feeling. If I were choosing by considerations of intellect alone, I could not have found anything better. However many women and girls he thought of whom he knew, he could not think of a girl who united to such a degree all, positively all, the qualities he would wish to see in his wife. She had all the charm and freshness of youth, but she was not a child. And if she loved him consciously, as a woman ought to love. That was one thing. Another point, she was not only far from being worldly, but had an unmistakable distaste for worldly society, and at the same time she knew the world, and had all the ways of a woman of the best society, which were absolutely essential to Sergey Ivanovich's conception of the woman who was to share his life. Thirdly, she was religious, not like a child, unconsciously religious and good, as Kitty, for example, was, but her life was founded on religious principles. Even in trifling matters, Sergey Ivanovich found in her all that he wanted in his wife. She was poor and alone in the world, so she would not bring with her a mass of relations and their influence into her husband's house, as he saw now in Kitty's case. She would owe everything to her husband, which was what he had always desired, too, for his future family life. And this girl, who united all these qualities, loved him. He was a modest man, but he could not help seeing it, and he loved her. There was one consideration against it, his age, but he came of a long-lived family. He had not a single gray hair. No one would have taken him for 40, and he remembered Varenka saying it was only in Russia that men of 50 thought themselves old, and that in France a man of 50 considers himself dans la forge de l'âge, while a man of 40 is un jeune homme. But what did the mere reckoning of years matter when he felt as young in heart as he had been 20 years ago? Was it not youth to feel as he felt now, when coming from the other side to the edge of the wood, he saw in the glowing light of the slanting sunbeams the graceful figure of Varenka, in her yellow gown with her basket, walking lightly by the trunk of an old birch tree. And when this impression of the sight of Varenka blended so harmoniously with the beauty of the view, of the yellow oak field lying bathed in the slanting sunshine, and beyond it the distant ancient forest, flecked with yellow and melting into the blue of the distance, his heart throbbed joyously. A softened feeling came over him. He felt that he had made up his mind. Varenka, who had just crouched down to pick a mushroom, rose with a subtle movement and looked around. Flinging away the cigar, Sergey Ivanovich advanced with resolute steps toward her. Chapter 5. Varvara Andreevna, when I was very young, I set before myself the ideal of the woman I love and should be happy to call my wife. I have lived through a long life, and now for the first time I have met what I sought in you. I love you and offer you my hand. Sergey Ivanovich was saying this to himself while he was 10 paces from Varenka. Kneeling down with her hands over the mushrooms to guard them from Grisha, she was calling little Masha. Come here, little ones. There are so many, she was saying in her sweet, deep voice. Seeing Sergey Ivanovich approaching, she did not get up and did not change her position, but everything told him that she felt his presence and was glad of it. Well, did you find some? She asked from under the white kerchief, turning her handsome, gently smiling face to him. Not one, Sister Day Ivanovich. Did you? She did not answer, busy with the children who thronged about her. That one, too, near the twig, she pointed out to little Masha, a little fungus, split in half across its rosy cap by the dry grass from under which it thrust itself. Varenka got up while Masha picked the fungus, breaking it into two white halves. This brings back my childhood, she added, moving apart from the children to Sergei Ivanovich's side. They walked on for a few steps in silence. Varenka saw that he wanted to speak. She guessed of what, and felt faint with joy and panic. They had walked so far away that no one could hear them now, but still he did not begin. It would have been better for Varenka to be silent. After a silence, it would have been easier for them to say what they wanted to say than after talking about mushrooms. But against her own will, as it were accidentally, Varenka said, "So you found nothing? In the middle of the wood, there are always fewer, though." Sergei Ivanovich sighed and made no answer. He was annoyed that she had spoken about the mushrooms. He wanted to bring her back to the first word she had uttered about her childhood, but after a pause of some length, as though against his own will, he made an observation in response to her last words. "I have heard that the white edible fungi are found principally at the edge of the wood, though I can't tell them apart." Some minutes more passed. They moved still farther away from the children and were quite alone. Varenka's heart throbbed so that she heard it beating and felt that she was turning red and pale and red again. To be the wife of a man like Koznishev, after her position with Madame Stahl, was to her imagination the height of happiness. Besides, she was almost certain that she was in love with him. In this moment, it would have to be decided. She felt frightened. She dreaded both his speaking and his not speaking. Now or never, it must be said, Sergei Ivanovich felt that too. Everything in the expression, the flushed cheeks and the downcast eyes of Varenka, betrayed a painful suspense. Sergei Ivanovich saw it and felt sorry for her. He felt even that to say nothing now would be a slight to her. Rapidly in his own mind, he ran over all the arguments in support of his decision. He even said over to himself the words in which he meant to put his proposal. But instead of those words, some utterly unexpected reflection that occurred to him made him ask, "What is the difference between the birch mushroom and the white mushroom?" Varenka's lips quivered with emotion as she answered, "In the top part there is scarcely any difference. It's in the stalk." And as soon as these words were uttered, both he and she felt that it was over, that what was to have been said would not be said, and their emotion, which up to then had been continually growing more intense, began to subside. The birch mushroom stalk suggests a dark man's chin after 2 days without shaving, said Sergei Ivanovich, speaking quite calmly now. "Yes, that's true," answered Varenka, smiling, and unconsciously direction of their walk changed. They began to turn toward the children. Varenka felt both hurt and ashamed. At the same time, she felt a sense of relief. When he had gone home again and went over the whole set of arguments, Sergei Ivanovich thought his previous decision had been a mistaken one. He could not be false to the memory of Marie. "Gently, children, gently," Levin shouted quite angrily to the children, standing before his wife to protect her when the crowd of children flew with streaks of delight to meet them. Behind the children, Sergei Ivanovich and Varenka walked out of the forest. Kitty had no need to ask Varenka. She saw from the calm and somewhat crestfallen faces of both that her plans had not come off. "Well," her husband questioned her as they were going home again. "No bite," said Kitty, her smile and manner of speaking recalling her father, a likeness Levin often noticed with pleasure. "No bites, how?" "I'll show you," she said, taking her husband's hand, lifting it to her mouth and just faintly brushing it with closed lips. "Like a kiss on a priest's hand." "Which one didn't bite?" he said, laughing. "Both, but it should have been like this. There are some peasants coming." "Oh, they didn't see." Chapter 6 During the time of the children's tea, the grown-ups sat on the balcony and talked as though nothing had happened, though they all, especially Sergei Ivanovich and Varenka, were very well aware that there had happened an event which, though negative, was of very great importance. They both had the same feeling, rather like that of a schoolboy after an unlucky examination, which has left him in the same class or shut him out of school forever. Everyone present, also feeling that something had happened, talked eagerly about extraneous subjects. Levin and Kitty were particularly happy and conscious of their love that evening, and their happiness and their love seemed to imply a disagreeable reference to those who would have liked to feel the same and could not, and they felt a prick of conscience. "Mark my words, Alexandra will not come," said the old princess. That evening they were expecting Stepan Arkadyevich to come down by train, and the old prince had written that possibly he might come too. "And I know why," the princess went on. "He says that newly married couples ought to be left alone for a while at first." "But Papa has left us alone. We've never seen him," said Kitty. "Besides, we're not newly married. We're old married people by now." "Only if he doesn't come, I shall say goodbye to your children," said the princess, sighing mournfully. "What nonsense, Mama!" Both the daughters fell upon her at once. "How do you suppose he is feeling? Why now?" And suddenly there was an unexpected quiver in the princess's voice. Her daughters were silent and looked at one another. "Mama always finds something to be miserable about," they said in that glance. They did not know that happy as the princess was in her daughter's house, and useful as she felt herself to be there, she had been extremely miserable, both on her own account and her husband's, ever since they had married off their last and favorite daughter and their family nest had been left empty. "What is it, Agatha Mikhailovna?" Kitty asked suddenly of Agatha Mikhailovna, who was standing with a mysterious air and a face full of meaning. "About supper?" "That's right," said Dolly. "You go and arrange about it, and I'll go and hear Grisha repeat his lesson, or else he will have done nothing all day." "That's my duty." "No, Dolly, I'm going," said Levin, jumping up. Grisha, who was by now at a high school, had to go over the lessons of the term in the summer holidays. Darya Alexandrovna, who had been studying Latin with her son in Moscow before, had made it a rule on coming to the Levins to go over with him at least once a day the most difficult lessons of Latin and arithmetic. Levin had offered to take her place, but the mother, having once overheard Levin's lesson and noticing that it was not given exactly as the teacher in Moscow had given it, said resolutely, though with much embarrassment and anxiety not to mortify Levin, that they must keep strictly to the book as the teacher had done, and that she had better undertake it again herself. Levin was amazed both at Stepan Arkadyevich, who, by neglecting his duty, threw upon the mother the supervision of studies of which she had no comprehension, and at the teachers for teaching the children so badly. But he promised his sister-in-law to give the lessons exactly as she wished, and he went on teaching Grisha, not in his own way, but by the book, and so took little interest in it, and often forgot the hour of the lesson. So it had been today. "No, I'm going, Dolly. You sit still," he said. "We'll do it all properly according to the book. Only when Stiva comes and we go out shooting, then we shall have to miss it." And Levin went to Grisha. Varenka was saying the same thing to Kitty. Even in the happy, well-ordered household of the Levins, Varenka had succeeded in making herself useful. "I'll see to the supper. You sit still," she said, and got up to go to Agatha Mikhailovna. "Yes, yes, most likely they've not been able to get chickens. If so, our..." "Agatha Mikhailovna and I will see about it," and Varenka vanished with her. "What a fine girl," said the princess. "Not merely fine, Mama. She's an exquisite girl. There's no one else like her." "So you are expecting Stepan Arkadyevich today?" said Sergei Ivanovich, evidently not disposed to pursue the conversation about Varenka. "It would be difficult to find two sons-in-law more unlike than yours," he said with a subtle smile. "One, mobility itself, only living in society like a fish in water. The other, our Kostya, lively, alert, quick in everything, but as soon as he is in society, he either sinks into apathy or struggles helplessly like a fish on land." "Yes, he's very heedless," said the princess, addressing Sergei Ivanovich. "I've intended, indeed, to ask you to tell him that it's out of the question for her," she indicated Kitty, "to stay here, that she positively must come to Moscow. He talks of getting a doctor down." "Mama, he'll do everything. He has agreed to everything," Kitty said, angry with her mother for appealing to Sergei Ivanovich to judge in such a matter. In the middle of their conversation, they heard the snorting of horses and the sound of wheels on the gravel. Dolly had not time to get up to go and meet her husband when, from the window of the room below, where Grisha was having his lesson, Levin leaped out and helped Grisha out after him. "It's Stiva," Levin shouted from under the balcony. "We've finished, Dolly. Don't be afraid," he added, and started running like a boy to meet the carriage. "Izhus, Izhus, Izhus," shouted Grisha, skipping along the avenue. "And someone else, too. Papa, of course," cried Levin, stopping at the entrance of the avenue. "Kitty, don't come down the steep staircase. Go round." But Levin had been mistaken in taking the person sitting in the carriage for the old prince. As he got nearer to the carriage, he saw beside Stepan Arkadyevich not the prince, but a handsome, stout young man in a Scotch cap, with long ends of ribbon behind. This was Vasenka Veslovsky, a distant cousin of the Shcherbatskys, a brilliant young gentleman in Petersburg and Moscow society, a capital fellow, and a keen sportsman, as Stepan Arkadyevich said, introducing him. Not a whit abashed by the disappointment caused by his having come in place of the old prince, Veslovsky greeted Levin gaily, claiming acquaintance with him in the past, and snatching up Grisha into the carriage, lifted him over the pointer that Stepan Arkadyevich had brought with him. Levin did not get into the carriage, but walked behind. He was rather vexed at the non-arrival of the old prince, whom he liked more and more the more he saw him, and also the arrival of this Vasenka Veslovsky, a quite alien and superfluous person. He seemed to him still more alien and superfluous when, on approaching the steps, where the whole party, children and grown-ups, were gathered together in much animation, Levin saw Vasenka Veslovsky with a particularly warm and gallant air kissing Kitty's hand. "Your wife and I are cousins and very old friends," said Vasenka Veslovsky, once more shaking Levin's hand with great warmth. "Well, are there plenty of birds?" Stepan Arkadyevich said to Levin, hardly leaving time for everyone to exchange greetings. "We've come with the most savage intentions. Why, Mama, they've not been in Moscow since. Look, Tanya, there's something for you. Get it, please. It's in the carriage, behind." He talked in all directions. "How pretty you've grown, Dolinka," he said to his wife, once more kissing her hand, holding it in one of his and patting it with the other. Levin, who a minute before had been in the happiest frame of mind, now looked darkly at everyone, and everything displeased him. "Who was it he kissed yesterday with those lips?" he thought, looking at Stepan Arkadyevich's tender demonstrations to his wife. He looked at Dolly, and he did not like her either. "She doesn't believe in his love, so what is she pleased about? Revolting," thought Levin. He looked at the princess who had been so dear to him a minute before, and he did not like the manner in which she welcomed this Vasenka with his ribbons, just as though she were in her own house. Even Sergei Ivanovich, who had come out too on the steps, seemed to him unpleasant with the show of cordiality with which he met Stepan Arkadyevich, though Levin knew that his brother neither liked nor respected Oblonsky. And Varenka? Even she seemed hateful, with her air Saint Natouche, making the acquaintance of this gentleman, while all the while she was thinking of nothing but getting married. And more hateful than anyone was Kitty for falling in with the tone of gaiety with which this gentleman regarded his visit in the country, as though it were a holiday for himself and everyone else. And more unpleasant than everything else was that peculiar smile with which she responded to his smile. Noisily talking, they all went into the house, but as soon as they were all seated, Levin turned and went out. Kitty saw something was wrong with her husband. She tried to seize a moment to speak to him alone, but he made haste to get away from her, saying he was wanted at the counting house. It was long since his own work on the estate had seemed to him so important as at that moment. It's all holiday for them, he thought, but these are no holiday matters. They won't wait, and there's no living without them. Chapter 7. Levin came back to the house only when they sent to summon to supper. On the stairs were standing Kitty and Agatha Mikhailovna, consulting about wines for supper. "But why are you making all this fuss? Have what we usually do." "No, Stiva doesn't drink. Kostya, stop. What's the matter? Kitty began, hurrying after him, but he strode ruthlessly away to the dining room without waiting for her, and at once joined in the lively general conversation which was being maintained there by Vasenka Veslovsky and Stepan Arkadyevich. Well, what do you say? Are we going shooting tomorrow? Said Stepan Arkadyevich. Please, do let's go, said Veslovsky, moving to another chair, where he sat down sideways with one fat leg crossed under him. I shall be delighted. We will go. And have you had any shooting yet this year? Said Levin to Veslovsky, looking intently at his leg, but speaking with that forced amiability that Kitty knew so well in him, and that was so out of keeping with him. I can't answer for our finding double snipe, but there are plenty of jacksnipe. Only we ought to start early. You're not tired? Aren't you tired, Stiva? Me tired? I've never been tired yet. Suppose we stay up all night. Let's go for a walk. Yes, really. Let's not go to bed at all. Capital, Veslovsky chimed in. Oh, we all know you can do without sleep and keep other people up, too, Dolly said to her husband, with that faint note of irony in her voice which she almost always had now with her husband. But to my thinking, it's time for bed now. I am going. I don't want supper. No, do stay a little, Dolenka, said Stepan Arkadyevich, going round to her side behind the table where they were having supper. I've so much still to tell you. Nothing really, I suppose. Do you know Veslovsky has been at Anna's, and he's going to them again? You know they're hardly 70 verstas from you, and I too must certainly go over there. Veslovsky, come here. Vasenka crossed over to the ladies and sat down beside Kitty. Ah, do tell me, please. You have visited her? How was she? Darya Alexandrovna appealed to him. Levin was left at the other end of the table, and though never pausing in his conversation with the princess and Varenka, he saw that there was an eager and mysterious conversation going on between Stepan Arkadyevich, Dolly, Kitty, and Veslovsky. And that was not all. He saw in his wife's face an expression of real feeling as she gazed with fixed eyes on the handsome face of Vasenka, who was telling them something with great animation. It's exceedingly nice at their place, Veslovsky was telling them about Vronsky and Anna. I can't, of course, take it upon myself to judge, but in their house you feel the real feeling of home. What do they intend doing? I believe they think of going to Moscow for the winter. How jolly it would be for us all to go over to them together. When are you going there, Stepan Arkadyevich asked Vasenka. I'm spending July there. Will you go, Stepan Arkadyevich said to his wife. I've been wanting to a long while. I shall certainly go, said Dolly. I am sorry for her, and I know her. She's a splendid woman. I will go alone when you go back, and then I shall be in no one's way, and it will be better indeed without you. To be sure, said Stepan Arkadyevich. And you, Kitty? I? Why should I go, Kitty said, flushing all over, and she glanced round at her husband. Do you know Anna Arkadyevna, then? Veslovsky asked her. She's a very fascinating woman. Yes, answered Veslovsky, crimsoning still more. She got up and walked across to her husband. Are you going shooting, then, tomorrow? She said. His jealousy had, and these few moments, especially at the flush, that had overspread her cheeks while she was talking to Veslovsky, gone far indeed. Now as he heard her words, he construed them in his own fashion. Strange as it was to him afterward to recall it, it seemed to him at the moment clear that in asking whether he was going shooting, all she cared to know was whether he would give that pleasure to Vasenka Veslovsky, with whom, as he fancied, she was in love. Yes, I'm going, he answered her in an unnatural voice, disagreeable to himself. No, better spend the day here tomorrow, or Dolly won't see anything of her husband, and set off the day after, said Kitty. A motive of Kitty's words was interpreted by Levin thus. Don't separate me from him. I don't care about your going, but do let me enjoy the society of this delightful young man. Oh, if you wish, we'll stay here tomorrow, Levin answered with peculiar amiability. Vasenka, meanwhile, utterly unsuspecting the misery his presence had occasioned, got up from the table after Kitty, and watching her with smiling and admiring eyes, he followed her. Levin saw that look. He turned white, and for a minute he could hardly breathe. How dare he look at my wife like that, was the feeling that boiled within him. Tomorrow, then. Do, please, let us go, said Vasenka, sitting down on a chair, and again crossing his leg as his habit was. Levin's jealousy went further still. Already he saw himself a deceived husband, looked upon by his wife and her lover as simply necessary to provide them with the conveniences and pleasures of life. But in spite of that, he made polite and hospitable inquiries of Vasenka about his shooting, his gun, and his boots, and agreed to go shooting next day. Happily for Levin, the old princess cut short his agonies by getting up herself and advising Kitty to go to bed. But even at this point, Levin could not escape another agony. As he said goodnight to his hostess, Vasenka would again have kissed her hand, but Kitty, reddening, drew back her hand and said with a naive bluntness, for which the old princess scolded her afterward, "We don't like that fashion." In Levin's eyes, she was to blame for having allowed such relations to arise, and still more to blame for showing so awkwardly that she did not like them. "Why, how can one want to go to bed?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, who, after drinking several glasses of wine at supper, was now in his most charming and lyrical humor. "Look, Kitty," he said, pointing to the moon which had just risen behind the linden trees. "How exquisite. Veslovsky, this is the time for a serenade. You know he has a splendid voice. We practiced songs together along the road. He has brought some lovely songs with him, two new ones. Varvara Andreevna and he must sing some duets." When the party had broken up, Stepan Arkadyevitch walked a long while about the avenue with Veslovsky. Their voices could be heard singing one of the new songs. Levin, hearing these voices, sat scowling in an easy chair in his wife's bedroom and maintained an obstinate silence while she asked him what was wrong. But when at last, with a timid glance, she hazarded the question, "Was there perhaps something you disliked about Veslovsky?" it all burst out, and he told her all. He was hurt himself by what he was saying, and that exasperated him all the more. He stood facing her with his eyes glittering menacingly under his scowling brows, and he squeezed his strong arms across his chest, as though he were straining every nerve to hold himself in. The expression of his face would have been grim and even cruel if it had not, at the same time, had a look of suffering which touched her. His jaws were twitching, and his voice kept breaking. "You must understand that I'm not jealous. That's a nasty word. I can't be jealous, and believe that. I can't say what I feel, but this is awful. I'm not jealous, but I'm wounded, humiliated that anybody dare think, that anybody dare look at you with eyes like that." "Eyes like what?" said Kitty, trying as conscientiously as possible to recall every word and gesture of that evening and every shade implied in them. At the very bottom of her heart, she did think there had been something, precisely at the moment when he had crossed over after her to the other end of the table, but she dared not own it even to herself, and would have been even more unable to bring herself to say so to him, and so increase his suffering. "And what can there possibly be attractive about me as I am now?" "Ah," he cried, clutching at his head, "you shouldn't say that. If you had been attractive, then..." "Oh, no, Kostya. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, do listen," she said, looking at him with an expression of pained commiseration. "Why, what can you be thinking about? When for me there's no one in the world, no one, no one. Would you like me never to see anyone?" For the first minute she had been offended at his jealousy. She was angry that the slightest amusement, even the most innocent, should be forbidden her. But now she would readily have sacrificed not merely such trifles, but everything for his peace of mind, to save him from the agony he was suffering. "You must understand the horror and comedy of my position," he went on in a desperate whisper, "that he's in my house, that he's done nothing positively improper. One can take exception only to his free and easy airs and the way he tucks his legs in under him. He thinks it's the best possible form, and so I'm obliged to be civil to him." "But, Kostya, you're exaggerating," said Kitty at the bottom of her heart, rejoicing at the depth of his love for her, shown now in his jealousy. "The most awful part of it all is that you're just as you always are, and especially now when to me you're something sacred, and we're so happy, so particularly happy, and all of a sudden a little wretch. He's not a little wretch, but why should I abuse him? I have nothing to do with him. But why should my and your happiness..." "Do you know I understand now what it all came from?" Kitty was beginning. "Well, what? What?" "I saw how you looked while we were talking at supper." "Well, well," said Levin in dismay. She told him what they had been talking about, and as she told him, she was breathless with emotion. Levin was silent for a space. Then he scanned her pale and distressed face, and suddenly clutched at his head. Katya, I've been worrying you. Darling, forgive me. It's madness. Katya, I'm a criminal. And how could you be so distressed at such idiocy? Oh, I was sorry for you. For me, how mad I am. But why make you miserable? It's awful to think that any outsider can shatter our happiness. It's humiliating, too, of course. Oh, then I'll keep him here all the summer, and we'll overwhelm him with civility, said Levin, kissing her hands. You shall see. Tomorrow. Oh, yes, we are going tomorrow. Chapter 8. Next day, before the ladies were up, the carriages for the shooting party, the droshky and a trap were at the door, and Laska, aware since early morning that they were going shooting, after much whining and darting to and fro, had sat herself down in the droshky beside the coachman, and, disapproving of the delay, was excitedly watching the door from which the sportsmen did not issue. The first to come out was Vasenka Veslovsky, in his new high boots that reached halfway up his thick thighs, in a green blouse with a new cartridge belt, redolent of leather, and in his Scotch cap with ribbons, with a brand new English gun without a sling. Laska flew up to him, welcomed him, and jumping up, asked him in her own way whether the others were coming soon. But getting no answer from him, she returned to her post of observation and sank into repose again, her head on one side and one ear pricked up to listen. At last the door opened with a creak, and Stepan Arkadyevich's spot and tan pointer, Crack, flew out, running round and round and turning over in the air. Stepan Arkadyevich himself followed with a gun in his hand and a cigar in his mouth. So ho, Crack, he cried encouragingly to the dog, who put his paws up on his chest, catching at his game bag. Stepan Arkadyevich was dressed in brogues and puttees, in torn trousers and a short coat. On his head there was a wreck of a hat of indefinite form, but his gun of a new patent was a perfect gem, and his game bag and cartridge belt, though worn, were of the very best quality. Vasenka Veslovsky had no notion before that it was truly cheap for a sportsman to be in tatters, but to have his shooting outfit of the best quality. He saw it now as he looked at Stepan Arkadyevich, radiant in his rags, graceful, well-fed, and joyous, a typical Russian nobleman, and he made up his mind that next time he went shooting he would certainly adopt the same get-up. Well, and what about our host? He asked. A young wife, said Stepan Arkadyevich, smiling. Yes, and such a charming one. He came down dressed. No doubt he's run up to her again. Stepan Arkadyevich guessed right. Levin had run up again to his wife to ask her once more if she forgave him for his idiocy yesterday, and moreover to beg her in Christ's name to be more careful. The great thing was for her to keep away from the children. They might any minute jostle against her. Then he had once more to hear her declare that she was not angry with him for going away for 2 days, and to beg her to be sure to send a note next morning by a servant on horseback, to write him, if it were but 2 words only, to let him know that all was well with her. Was at parting for a couple days from her husband, but when she saw his eager figure, looking big and strong in his shooting boots and his white blouse, and a sort of sportsman elation and excitement incomprehensible to her, she forgot her own chagrin for the sake of his pleasure, and said goodbye to him cheerfully. "Pardon, gentlemen," he said, running out on the steps. "Have you put the lunch in? Why is the chestnut on the right? Well, it doesn't matter. Laska, down. Go and lie down." "Put them with the herd of heifers," he said to the herdsman, who was waiting for him at the steps, to ask him what was to be done with the geld oxen. "Excuse me, here comes another villain." Levin jumped out of the droshky, in which he had already taken his seat, to meet the carpenter, who came toward the steps with a rule in his hand. "You didn't come to the counting house yesterday, and now you're detaining me. Well, what is it?" "Would your honor let me make another turning? There's only 3 steps to add, and we make it just fit at the same time. It will be much more convenient." "You should have listened to me," Levin answered with annoyance. "I said, put the lines and then fit in the steps. Now there's no setting it right. Do as I told you and make a new staircase." The point was that in the wing that was being built, the carpenter had spoiled the staircase, fitting it together without calculating the space it was to fill, so that the steps were all sloping when it was put in place. Now the carpenter wanted to keep the same staircase by adding three steps. It will be much better. But where is your staircase coming out with its three steps? Why, upon my word, sir, the carpenter said with a contemptuous smile, it comes out right at the very spot. It starts here, he said with a persuasive gesture. Then it'll go up and come out. But three steps will add to the length, too. Where is it to come out? Why, to be sure, it'll go up and come out, the carpenter said obstinately and convincingly. It'll reach the ceiling and the wall. Upon my word, why, it'll go up and come out like this. Levin took out a ramrod and began sketching him the staircase in the dust. There, do you see? As your honor likes, said the carpenter with a sudden gleam in his eyes, obviously understanding the thing at last. It seems it'll be best to make a new one. Well, then, do it as you're told, Levin shouted, seating himself in the droshky. Down. Hold the dogs, Philip. Levin felt now at leaving behind all his family and household cares such an eager sense of joy in life and expectation that he was not disposed to talk. Besides that, he had that feeling of concentrated excitement that every sportsman experiences as he approaches the scene of action. If he had anything on his mind at that moment, it was only the doubt whether they would start anything in the Kolpensky Marsh, whether Laska would show to advantage in comparison with Crack, and whether he would shoot well that day himself. Not to disgrace himself before a new spectator, not to be outdone by Oblonsky, that, too, was a thought that crossed his brain. Oblonsky was feeling the same, and he, too, was not talkative. Vasenka Veslovsky alone kept up a ceaseless flow of cheerful chatter. As he listened to him now, Levin felt ashamed to think how unfair he had been to him the day before. Vasenka was really a fine fellow, simple, good-hearted, and very good-humored. If Levin had met him before he was married, he would have made friends with him. Levin rather disliked his holiday attitude to life and a sort of free and easy assumption of elegance. It was as though he assumed a high degree of importance in himself that could not be disputed, because he had long nails and a stylish cap, and everything else to correspond. But this could be forgiven for the sake of his good nature and good breeding. Levin liked him for his good education, for speaking French and English with such an excellent accent, and for being a man of his world. Vasenka was extremely delighted with the left outrigger, a horse of the Don's steps. He kept praising him enthusiastically. How fine it must be galloping over the steps on a step horse, eh? Isn't it? He said. He had imagined riding on a step horse as something wild and romantic, and it turned out nothing of the sort. But his simplicity, particularly in conjunction with his good looks, his amiable smile, and the grace of his movements, was very attractive. Either because his nature was sympathetic to Levin, or because Levin was trying to atone for his sins of the previous evening by seeing nothing but what was good in him, at any rate, he liked his society. After they had driven three verstas from home, Veslovsky all at once felt for a cigar and his pocketbook, and did not know whether he had lost them or left them on the table. In the pocketbook, there were 370 rubles, and so the matter could not be left in uncertainty. Do you know what, Levin? I'll gallop home on that outrigger. That will be splendid, eh? He said, preparing to get out. No, why should you? Answered Levin, calculating that Vasenka could hardly weigh less than 6 poods. I'll send the coachman. The coachman rode back on the outrigger, and Levin himself drove the remaining pair. Chapter 9. Well now, what's our plan of campaign? Tell us all about it, said Stepan Arkadyevich. Our plan is this. Now we're driving to Gvozdyov. In Gvozdyov, there's a double snipe marsh on this side, and beyond Gvozdyov come some magnificent jacksnipe marshes, where there are double snipe too. It's hot now, and we'll get there. It's 20 verstas, toward evening, and have some evening shooting. We'll spend the night there and go on tomorrow to the bigger moors. And is there nothing on the way? Yes, but we'll save ourselves. Besides, it's hot. There are 2 good little places, but I doubt there being anything to shoot. Levin would himself have liked to go into these little places, but they were near home. He could shoot them over any time, and they were only little places. There would hardly be room for three to shoot. And so, with some insincerity, he said that he doubted there being anything to shoot. When they reached a little marsh, Levin would have driven by, but Stepan Arkadyevich, with the experienced eye of a sportsman, at once detected a soggy spot visible from the road. "Shan't we try that?" he said, pointing to the little marsh. "Levin, do, please. How delightful," Vasinka Veslovsky began begging, and Levin could not but consent. Before they had time to stop, the dogs had flown one before the other into the marsh. "Crack, Laska," the dogs came back. "There won't be room for three. I'll stay here," said Levin, hoping they would find nothing but peewits, which had been startled by the dogs, and turning over in their flight were plaintively wailing over the marsh. "No, come along, Levin. Let's go together," Veslovsky called. "Really, there's no room. Laska, back, Laska. You won't want another dog, will you?" Levin remained with the droshky and looked enviously at the sportsmen. They walked across the marsh. Except one moor hen and peewits, of which Vasinka killed one, there was nothing in the marsh. "Come, you see now that it was not that I grudged the marsh," said Levin, "only it's wasting time." "Oh, no, it was jolly all the same. Did you see us?" said Vasinka Veslovsky, clambering awkwardly into the droshky with his gun and his peewit in his hand. "How splendidly I shot this bird, didn't I? Well, shall we soon be getting to the real place?" The horses started off suddenly. Levin knocked his head against the stock of someone's gun, and there was the report of a shot. The gun did actually go off first, but that was how it seemed to Levin. It appeared that Vasinky Veslovsky, making the cock safe, had pressed one trigger and had held back the other cock. The charge flew into the ground without doing harm to anyone. Stepan Arkadyevich shook his head and laughed reprovingly at Veslovsky. But Levin had not the heart to reprove him. In the first place, any reproach would have seemed to be called forth by the danger he had incurred and the bump that had come up on Levin's forehead. And besides, Veslovsky was at first so naively distressed and then laughed so good-humoredly and infectiously at their general dismay that one could not but laugh with him. When they reached the second marsh, which was fairly large and would inevitably take some time to shoot over, Levin tried to persuade them to pass it by. But Veslovsky again talked him over. Again, as the marsh was narrow, Levin, like a good host, remained with the carriages. Crack made straight for hummocks. Vasinka Veslovsky was the first to run after the dog. Before Stepan Arkadyevich had time to come up, a double snipe flew out. Veslovsky missed it, and it flew into an unmown meadow. This double snipe was left for Veslovsky to follow up. Crack found it again and pointed, and Veslovsky shot it and went back to the carriages. "Now you go, and I'll stay with the horses," he said. Levin had begun to feel the pangs of a sportsman's envy. He handed the reins to Veslovsky and walked into the marsh. Laska, who had been plaintively whining and fretting against the injustice of her treatment, flew straight ahead to an unfailing place, covered with mossy hummocks that Levin knew well and that Crack had not yet come upon. "Why don't you stop her?" shouted Stepan Arkadyevich. "She won't scare them," answered Levin, sympathizing with his bitch's pleasure and hurrying after her. As she came nearer and nearer to the familiar hummocks, there was more and more earnestness in Laska's exploration. A little marsh bird did not divert her attention for more than an instant. She made one circuit around the hummocks, was beginning a second, and suddenly quivered with excitement and stood stock still. "Come, come, Stiva," shouted Levin, feeling his heart beginning to beat more violently, and all of a sudden, as though some sort of shudder had been drawn back from his straining ears, all sounds, confused but loud, began to beat on his hearing, losing all sense of distance. He heard the steps of Stepan Arkadyevich, mistaking them for the tramp of the horses in the distance. He heard the brittle sound of the tussock which came off with its roots when he had trodden on a hummock, and he took this sound for the flight of a double snipe. He heard, too, not far behind him, a splashing in the water, which he could not explain to himself. Picking his steps, he moved up to the dog. "Fetch it." Not a double, but a jackknife flew up from beside the dog. Levin had lifted his gun, but at the very instant when he was taking aim, the sound of splashing grew louder, came closer, and was joined with the sound of Veslovsky's voice,
shouting something with strange loudness. Levin saw he had his gun pointed behind the snipe, but still he fired. When he had made sure he had missed, Levin looked round and saw the horses and droshky, not on the road, but in the marsh. Veslovsky, eager to see the shooting, had driven into the marsh and got the horses stuck in the mud. "Damn the fellow," Levin said to himself as he went back to the carriage that had sunk in the mire. "What did you drive in for?" he said to him dryly, and calling the coachman, he began pulling the horses out. Levin was vexed both at being hindered from shooting and at his horses getting stuck in the mud, and still more at the fact that neither Stepan Arkadyevich nor Veslovsky helped him and the coachman to unharness the horses and get them out, since neither of them had the slightest notion of harnessing. Without answering a syllable to Vasenka's protestations that it had been quite dry there, Levin worked in silence with the coachman at extricating the horses. But then, as he got warm at the work and saw how assiduously Veslovsky was tugging at the droshky by one of the splashboards, so that he broke it indeed, Levin blamed himself for having, under the influence of yesterday's feelings, been too cold to Veslovsky, and tried to be particularly genial so as to smooth over his chilliness. When everything had been put right and the vehicles had been brought back to the road, Levin had the lunch served. Bon appetit, bon conscience. Si poulet, botamber, jusqu'à fin de mes bottes. Vasenka, who had recovered his spirits, quoted the French saying as he finished his second chicken. "Well, now our troubles are over. Now everything's going to go well. Only, to atone for my sins, I'm bound to sit on the box." "That's so, eh?" "No, no. I'll be your automaton." "You shall see how I'll get you along," he answered without letting go the rein, when Levin begged him to let the coachman drive. "No, I must atone for my sins, and I'm very comfortable on the box." And he drove. Levin was a little afraid he would exhaust the horses, especially the left of them, the chestnut, whom he did not know how to hold in. But unconsciously he fell under the influence of his gaiety and listened to the songs he sang all the way on the box, or the descriptions and representations he gave of driving in the English fashion, four in hand, and it was in the very best of spirits after lunch they drove to the Gvozdyov Marsh. Chapter 10. Vasenka drove the horses so fast that they reached the marsh too early, while it was still hot. As they drew near this more important marsh, the chief aim of their expedition, Levin could not help considering how he could get rid of Vasenka and be free in his movements. Stepan Arkadyevich evidently had the same desire, and on his face Levin saw the look of anxiety always present in a true sportsman when beginning shooting, together with a certain good-humored slyness peculiar to him. "How shall we go? It's a splendid marsh, I see, and there are hawks," said Stepan Arkadyevich, pointing to two great birds hovering over the sedge. "Where there are hawks, there is sure to be game." "Now, gentlemen," said Levin, pulling up his boots and examining the lock of his gun with a somewhat somber expression, "do you see that sedge?" He pointed to an oasis of blackish green in the half-mown wet meadow that stretched along the right bank of the river. "The marsh begins here, straight in front of us, do you see, where it is greener? From here it runs to the right, where the horses are. There are hummocks there, and double snipe. And all round that sedge, as far as that alder tree, and right up to the mill. Over there, do you see where the creek is? That's the best place. There I once shot 17 jacksnipe. We'll separate with the dogs and go in different directions, and then meet over there at the mill." "Well, who'll go left and who to the right?" asked Stepan Arkadyevich. "It's wider to the right. You two go that way, and I'll take the left," he said with apparent carelessness. "Capital. We'll make the bigger bag. Yes, come along, come along," Vasenka exclaimed. Levin could do nothing but agree, and they divided. As soon as they entered the marsh, the two dogs began hunting about together and made toward the rust-colored spot. Levin knew Laska's method, wary and indefinite. He knew the place, too, and expected a whole covey of snipe. "Veslovsky, walk beside me," he said, in a faint voice to his companions splashing in the water behind him. Levin could not help feeling an interest in the direction his gun was pointed after that casual shot near the Kolpinski Marsh. "Oh, I won't get in your way. Don't trouble about me." But Levin could not help troubling and recalled Kitty's words at parting. "Mind you don't shoot one another." The dogs came nearer and nearer, past each other, each pursuing its own scent. The expectation of snipe was so intense that to Levin the smacking sound of his own heel, as he drew it up out of the rusty mire, seemed to be the call of a snipe, and he clutched and pressed the butt of his gun. Bang, bang, sounded almost in his ear. Vasenka had fired at a flock of ducks which was hovering over the marsh and flying at that moment toward the sportsman, far out of range. Before Levin had time to look around, there was the whir of one snipe, another, a third, and some eight more rose one after another. Stepan Arkadyevich hit one at the very moment when it was beginning its zigzag movements, and the snipe fell as a clod into the quagmire. Oblonsky aimed deliberately at another, still flying low toward the sedge, and together with the report of the shot, that snipe too fell, and it could be seen fluttering out where the sedge had been cut, its unhurt wing showing white beneath. Levin was not so lucky. He aimed at his first bird too low and missed. He aimed at it again just as it was rising, but at that instant another snipe flew up at his very feet, distracting him so that he missed again. While they were reloading their guns, another snipe rose, and Veslovsky, who had had time to reload again, sent two charges of small shot into the water. Stepan Arkadyevich picked up his snipe and with sparkling eyes looked at Levin. "Well, now let us separate," said Stepan Arkadyevich, and limping on his left foot, holding his gun in readiness and whistling to his dog, he walked off in one direction. Levin and Veslovsky walked off in the other. It always happened with Levin that when his first shots were a failure, he got heated and out of temper and shot badly the whole day. So was it that day. The snipe showed themselves in numbers. They kept flying up from just under the dogs, from under the sportsman's legs, and Levin might have retrieved his ill luck. But the more he shot, the more he felt disgraced in the eyes of Veslovsky, who kept hopping away merrily and indiscriminately, killing nothing, and not in the slightest abashed by his ill success. Levin, in feverish haste, could not restrain himself, got more and more out of temper, and ended up by shooting almost without a hope of hitting. Laska, indeed, seemed to understand this. She began searching more listlessly, and gazed back at the sportsman with apparent perplexity or reproach in her eyes. Shots followed shots in rapid succession. The smoke of the powder hung about the sportsman, while in the great roomy net of the game bag there were only three light, small snipe. And of these, one had been killed by Veslovsky alone, and one by both of them together. Meanwhile, from the other side of the marsh came the sound of Stepan Arkadyevich's shots, not frequent, but as Levin fancied, well-directed, for almost after each they heard, crack, crack, a porte. This excited Levin still more. The snipe were floating continually in the air over the sedge, their whirring wings close to the earth and their harsh cries high in the air, could be heard on all sides. The snipe that had risen first and flown up into the air settled again before the sportsman. Instead of two hawks, there were now dozens of them, hovering, with shrill cries over the marsh. After walking through the larger half of the marsh, Levin and Veslovsky reached the place where the peasants' mowing grass was divided into long strips reaching to the sedge, marked off in one place by the trampled grass, in another by a path mown through it. Half of these strips had already been mown. Though there was not so much hope of finding birds in the uncut part as the cut part, Levin had promised Stepan Arkadyevich to meet him, and so he walked on with his companion through the cut and uncut patches. "Hi, hunters," shouted one of a group of peasants, sitting on an unharnessed telega. "Come and have some lunch with us. Have a drop of wine." Levin looked round. "Come along, it's all right," shouted a good-humored-looking bearded peasant with a red face, showing his white teeth in a grin and holding up a greenish bottle that flashed in the sunlight. "Qu'est-ce qu'ils disent?" asked Veslovsky. "They invite you to have some vodka. Most likely they've been dividing the meadow into lots." "I should have some," said Levin, not without some guile, hoping Veslovsky would be tempted by the vodka and would go off to them. "Why do they offer it?" "Oh, they're merrymaking. Really, you should join them. You would be interested." Alan, say, Cyril.
You go,
you'll find the way to the mill, cried Levin. And looking round, he perceived with satisfaction that Veslovsky, bent and stumbling with weariness, holding his gun out at arm's length, was making his way out of the marsh toward the peasants.
You come too, the peasant shouted to Levin. Never fear, taste our pie.
Levin felt a strong inclination for a drink of vodka and a bite of bread. He was exhausted and felt it a great effort to drag his staggering legs out of the mire, and for a minute he hesitated. But Laska was pointing. And immediately all his weariness vanished, and he walked lightly through the swamp toward the dog. A snipe flew up at his feet. He fired and killed it. Laska still pointed. Fetch it. Another bird flew up close to the dog. Levin fired. But it was an unlucky day for him. He missed it. And when he went to look for the one he had shot, he could not find that either. He wandered all about the sedge, but Laska did not believe he had shot it. And when he sent her to find it, she pretended to hunt for it, but did not really do so. And in the absence of Vasenka, on whom Levin threw the blame of his failure, things went no better. There was plenty of snipe still, but Levin made one miss after another. The slanting rays of the sun were still hot. His clothes, soaked through with perspiration, stuck to his body. His left boot, full of water, weighed heavily on his leg and squelched at every step. The sweat ran in drops down his powder-grimed face. His mouth was full of a bitter taste, his nose of the smell of powder and stagnant water. His ears were ringing with the incessant whir of the snipe. He could not touch the barrel of his gun. It was so hot. His heart beat with short, rapid throbs. His hands shook with excitement, and his weary legs stumbled and staggered over the hummocks and in the swamp. But still he walked on, and still he shot. At last, after a disgraceful miss, he flung his gun and his hat on the ground. No, I must control myself, he said to himself. Picking up his gun and his hat, he called Laska and went out of the swamp. When he got onto dry ground, he sat down on a hummock, pulled off his boot and emptied it, then walked to the marsh, drank some rust-tasting water, moistened the burning hot barrel of his gun, and washed his hands and face. Feeling refreshed, he went back to the spot where a snipe had settled, firmly resolved to keep cool. He tried to be calm, but it was the same again. His finger pressed the trigger before he had taken a good aim at the bird. It got worse and worse. He had only 5 birds in his game bag when he walked out of the marsh toward the alders, where he was to rejoin Stepan Arkadyevich. Before he caught sight of Stepan Arkadyevich, he saw his dog, Crack, black all over with the stinking mire of the marsh, darted out from behind the twisted root of an alder, and with the air of a conqueror sniffed Laska. Behind Crack there came into view in the shade of the alder tree the shapely figure of Stepan Arkadyevich. He came to meet him, red and perspiring, with unbuttoned neckband, still limping in the same way. "Well, you have been popping away," he said, smiling good-humoredly. "How have you got on?" queried Levin, but there was no need to ask, for he had already seen the full game bag. "Oh, pretty fair. He had 14 birds. A splendid marsh. I've no doubt Veslovsky got in your way. It's awkward, too, shooting with one dog," said Stepan Arkadyevich, to soften his triumph. Chapter 11. When Levin and Stepan Arkadyevich reached the peasant's hut where Levin always used to stay, Veslovsky was already there. He was sitting in the middle of the hut, clinging with both hands to the bench from which he was being pulled by a soldier, the brother of the peasant's wife, who was helping him off with his miry boots. Veslovsky was laughing his infectious, good-humored laugh. "I've only just come. Ils ont été charmants. Just fancy they gave me drink and fed me. Such bread, it was exquisite. Delicieux. And the vodka, I never tasted any better. And they would not take a penny for anything, and they kept saying, 'Excuse our homely ways.' What should they take anything for? They were entertaining you, to be sure. Do you suppose they keep vodka for sale?" said the soldier, succeeding at last in pulling the soaked boot off, together with the blackened stocking. In spite of the dirtiness of the hut, which was all muddied by their boots and the filthy dogs licking themselves clean, and the smells of the marsh and the powder that filled the room, and the absence of knives and forks, the party drank their tea and ate their supper with a relish only known to sportsmen. Washed and clean, they went into a hay barn swept ready for them, where the coachman had been making up beds for the gentlemen. Though it was dusk, not one of them wanted to go to sleep. After wavering among reminiscences and anecdotes of guns, of dogs, and of former shooting parties, the conversation rested on a topic that interested all of them. After Vasenka had several times over expressed his appreciation of this delightful sleeping place among the fragrant hay, this delightful broken telega, he supposed it to be broken because the shafts had been taken out, of the good nature of the peasants who had treated him to vodka, of the dogs who lay at the feet of their respective masters, Oblonsky began telling them of a delightful shooting party at Malthaus, where he had stayed the previous summer. Malthaus was a well-known capitalist who had made his money by speculation in railway shares. Stepan Arkadyevich described what snipe moors this Malthaus had taken on lease in the Tver province, and how they were preserved, and of the carriages and dog carts in which the shooting party had been driven, and the luncheon pavilion that had been rigged up at the marsh. "I don't understand you," said Levin, sitting up in the hay. "How is it such people don't disgust you? I can understand a lunch with Lafitte is all very pleasant, but don't you dislike just that very sumptuousness? All these people, just like our tax farmers in the old days, get their money in a way that gains them the contempt of everyone. They don't care for their contempt, and then they use their dishonest gains to buy off the contempt they have deserved." "Perfectly true," chimed in Vasenka Veslovsky. "Perfectly. Oblonsky, of course, goes out of bonhomie, but other people say, well, Oblonsky stays with them." "Not a bit of it." Levin could hear that Oblonsky was smiling as he spoke. "I simply don't consider him more dishonest than any other wealthy merchant or nobleman. They've all made their money alike by their work and their intelligence." "Oh, by what work? Do you call it work to get hold of concessions and speculate with them?" "Of course it's work. Work in this sense, that if it were not for him and others like him, there would have been no railways. But that's not work, like the work of a peasant or in a learned profession." "Granted, but it's work in the sense that his activity produces a result, the railways. But, of course, you think the railways useless." "No, that's another question. I am disposed to admit that they are useful. But all profit that is out of proportion to the labor expended is dishonest." "But who is to define what is proportionate?" "Making profit by dishonest means, by trickery," said Levin, conscious that he could not draw a distinct line between honesty and dishonesty. "Such as banking, for instance," he went on. "It's an evil. The amassing of huge fortunes without labor. Just the same thing as with the tax farmers. It's only the form that's changed. Leroy is smart. Viva Leroy. No sooner were the tax farmers abolished than the railways came up, and banking companies. That, too, is profit without work." "Yes, that may all be very true and clever. Lie down, Crack." Stepan Arkadyevich called to his dog, who was scratching and turning over all the hay. He was obviously convinced of the correctness of his position, and so talked serenely and without haste. "But you have not drawn the line between honest and dishonest work. That I receive a bigger salary than my chief clerk, though he knows more about the work than I do, that's dishonest, I suppose." "I can't say." "Well, but I can tell you. You're receiving some 5,000, let's say, for your work on the land, while our host, the peasant here, however hard he works, can never get more than 50 rubles. It's just as dishonest as my earning more than my chief clerk and Malthus getting more than a railway expert. No, quite the contrary. I see that society takes up a sort of antagonistic attitude to these people, which is utterly baseless, and I fancy there's envy at the bottom of it." "No, that's unfair," said Veslovsky. "How could envy come in? There is something unclean about that sort of business." "You say," Levin went on, "that it's unjust for me to receive 5,000 while the peasant has 50 rubles. That's true. It is unfair, and I feel it, but it really is. Why is it we spend our time writing, drinking, shooting, doing nothing while they are forever at work?" said Vasenka Veslovsky, obviously for the first time in his life reflecting on the question, and consequently considering it with perfect sincerity. "Yes, you feel it, but you don't give him your property," said Stepan Arkadyevich, intentionally, as it seemed, provoking Levin. There had arisen of late something like a secret antagonism between the two brothers-in-law, as though, since they had married sisters, a kind of rivalry had sprung up between them as to which was ordering his life best. And now this hostility showed itself in the conversation as it began to take a personal note. I don't give it away because no one demands that from me. And if I wanted to, I could not give it away, answered Levin, and have no one to give it to. Give it to this peasant. He would not refuse it. Yes, but how am I to give it up? Am I to go to him and make a title deed? I don't know, but if you are convinced that you have no right, I am not at all convinced. On the contrary, I feel I have no right to give it up, that I have duties both to the land and to my family. No, excuse me, but if you consider this inequality as unjust, why is it you don't act accordingly? Well, I do act negatively on that idea, so far as not trying to increase the difference of position existing between him and me. No, excuse me, that's a paradox. Yes, there's something of a sophistry about that, Veslovsky agreed. Ah, our host, he said to the peasant who came into the barn opening the creaking door. How is it you're not asleep yet? No. How's one to sleep? I thought our gentleman would be asleep, but I heard them chattering. I want to get a hook from here. She won't bite, he added, stepping cautiously with his bare feet. And where are you going to sleep? We are going out for night watching. Ah, what a night, said Veslovsky, looking out at the edge of the hut and the unharnessed droshky that could be seen in the faint light of the evening glow and the great frame of the open doors. But listen, there are women's voices singing, and on my word, not badly, too. Who's that singing, my friend? That's the housemaids from hard by here. Let's go. Let's take a walk. We shan't go to sleep, you know. Oblonsky, come along. If one could only do both, lie here and go, answered Oblonsky, stretching. It's capital lying here. Well, I shall go by myself, said Veslovsky, getting up eagerly and putting on his boots and stockings. Goodbye, gentlemen. If it's fun, I'll fetch you. You've treated me to some good sport, and I won't forget you. He really is a capital fellow, isn't he, said Stepan Arkadyevich, when Veslovsky had gone out and the peasant had closed the door after him. Yes, capital, answered Levin, still thinking of the subject of their conversation just before. It seemed to him that he had clearly expressed his thoughts and feelings to the best of his capacity, and yet both of them, straightforward men and not fools, had said with one voice that he was comforting himself with sophistries. This disconcerted him. It's just this, my dear boy. One must do one of two things. Either admit that the existing order of society is just, and then stick up for one's rights in it, or acknowledge that you are enjoying unjust privileges as I do, and then enjoy them and be satisfied. No, if it were unjust, you could not enjoy these advantages and be satisfied. At least I could not. The great thing for me is to feel that I am not to blame. What do you say? Why not go after all, said Stepan Arkadyevich, evidently weary of the strain of thought. We shan't go to sleep, you know. Come, let's go. Levin did not answer. What they had said in the conversation, that he acted justly only in a negative sense, absorbed his thoughts. Can it be that it's only possible to be just negatively, he was asking himself. How strong the smell of the fresh hay is, though, said Stepan Arkadyevich, getting up. There's not a chance of sleeping. Vasenka has been getting up some fun there. Do you hear the laughter in his voice? Hadn't we better go? Come along. No, I'm not coming, answered Levin. Surely that's not a matter of principle, too, said Stepan Arkadyevich, smiling, as he felt about in the dark for his cap. It's not a matter of principle, but why should I go? But do you know you are preparing trouble for yourself, said Stepan Arkadyevich, finding his cap and getting up. How so? Do you suppose I don't see the line you've taken up with your wife? I heard how it's a question of the greatest consequence, whether or not you're to be away for a couple of days shooting. That's all very well as an idyllic episode, but for your whole life that won't answer. A man must be independent. He has his masculine interests. A man has to be manly, said Oblonsky, opening the door. In what way? To go running after servant girls, said Levin. Why not, if it amuses him? Kane tir has a consequence. It won't do my wife any harm, and it'll amuse me. The great thing is to respect the sanctity of the home. There should be nothing in the home, but don't tie your own hands. Perhaps so, said Levin dryly, and he turned on his side. Tomorrow early I want to go shooting, and I won't wake anyone, and shall set off at daybreak. Messieurs, venivite, they heard the voice of Veslovsky coming back. Charmante, I've made such a discovery. Charmante, a perfect Gretchen, and I've already made friends with her. Really exceedingly pretty, he declared in a tone of approval, as though she had been made pretty entirely on his account, and he were expressing his satisfaction with the entertainment that had been provided for him. Levin pretended to be asleep, while Oblonsky, putting on his slippers and lighting a cigar, walked out of the barn, and soon their voices were lost. For a long while, Levin could not get to sleep. He heard his horses munching hay, then he heard the peasant and his elder boy getting ready, and then going off for the night watching. Then he heard the soldier arranging his bed on the other side of the barn with his nephew, the younger son of his peasant host. He heard the boy in his shrill little voice telling his uncle what he thought about the dogs, who seemed to him huge and terrible creatures, and asking what the dogs were going to hunt next day, and the soldier, in a husky, sleepy voice, telling him the sportsmen were going in the morning to the marsh and would shoot with their guns, and then, to check the boy's questions, he said, "Go to sleep, Vaska. Go to sleep, or you'll catch it." And soon after, he began snoring himself, and everything was still. He could only hear the neigh of the horses and the guttural cry of a snipe. "Is it really only negative?" he repeated to himself. "Well, what of it? It's not my fault." And he began thinking about the next day.